Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we've brought you Delectables.
Delectables, oh, okay. I was thinking we were roaming the world with for delectables. I guess we are.
Anyhow, we do have an assortment on the program.
Oh, is that an assortment?
Assortment. Starting with some...
One of your favorite foods.
Yes, which is... now becoming popular with everybody else as well, which is edible seaweed. And we have a spokesperson, the CEO actually, Jin June of a company that makes wonderful seaweed snacks. So let's hear Jin June tell us about sea snacks. Yes, we're going to be talking seaweed next, with Jin Jun. Is that correct, Jin?
That's correct.
Okay. Who is the CEO, which is the chief eating officer of Sea Snacks, spelled S-E-A, capital S-N-A-X. And I've been eating it up, but I've always eaten seaweed. I have noticed, however, there is a new trend afoot, and it was very pronounced at the Fancy Food Show this summer, of using more edible seaweed in the Western cultures. Have you noticed that change too?
I have. When we started this business 5 years ago, I couldn't have imagined how quickly, you know, the trend in seaweed and interest in seaweed snacks would have grown. I've done hundreds of demos in the store and in the course of building this business, so I have seen the overwhelming response from children, from mothers, you know, adults, and people are just really jumping on board the seaweed snack bandwagon.
Now, it's interesting. Before we came on the air, I said you are from Korea, and you said yes, but you came to the United States when you were only 1 year old. And,
yes.
And you started the seaweed business 5 years ago. That sounds sort of like a Korean business. What were you doing in between?
Well, I was actually studying traditional Chinese medicine, and during the course of my studies, I became pregnant with my daughter, Namu, and started gaining a very keen interest in nutrition. And Chinese nutrition is actually a science in and of itself. It's tied in with the seasons and the elements, and I could write a thesis about it. You know, we don't have enough time to talk about it here, but I mean, it involves colors like, you know, red being good for the heart, and so you eat cherries and berries and things like that. And so I became very passionate about food and what I was eating, and so it started from there. And then once my daughter was born at the age of 3, she started devouring seaweed for some reason.
Uh-huh.
Maybe she wanted it, her body craved it, who knows. But when I took a closer look at what was out there in the conventional market, not like the health food market, you know, it concerned me because they were using some of the brands, the conventional brands, were using corn oil and tons of sodium. I mean, we're talking just, you know, processed table salt.
Yes.
And the way that my daughter was eating this, I said, oh, my goodness, if this goes on, she's going to have hypertension by the time she's a teenager. And so it all started with sort of her loving it so much that I wanted to create a very simple snack that had just better ingredients. And so we came up with olive oil because she's the one. She liked the olive oil. She said, Mommy, it tastes sweeter that way. You know, and in Asia, you know, people often do roast the seaweed themselves. They take the raw nori and then they roast it at home. But you have to have a gas burner and you have to know how to do it. It's very time intensive.
Now,
and so, yes?
Now, what is it that's in seaweed that makes it so good? And there are obviously some really beneficial things in there, otherwise people wouldn't have been eating it for such a long time. But what are they? Are they like iodine and things like that?
Yeah, I think iodine is a big one.
Right. Well, seaweed is a natural source of iodine, and because it comes from the ocean, it contains minerals. Well, iodine being one of them, iron, calcium, and, you know, I mean, if we were to, you know, test, you know, each batch of seaweed, you know, biologically, it probably contain more of various types of, you know, vitamins and minerals.
And where do you get your raw material from?
Our seaweed is harvested on the south coast of Korea and in very clean, pristine waters. And we work with a co-op of farmers that we've been working with for a very long time. And we actually helped them gain USDA organic certification.
Right.
When they knew nothing about it. And when we started the business, we couldn't find any organic seaweed in South Korea. So we're also sort of at the forefront of changing standards and quality.
I had this idea a while back, I'd say 6 months ago, that I wanted to write a feature about the whole range of edible seaweed finding a following in the Western cultures. So I contacted some big seaweed suppliers, of which there are not many. I contacted them through the internet, trying to set up interviews and samples and whatever. People, they would not send me any samples, like for media samples. I would have to have bought them, and they were in these huge quantities, and they cost a fortune. They were hundreds of dollars.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and I just gave up on that idea altogether. But who are they, I wonder? They in a different market altogether from snacks and so forth.
Where are these suppliers once again?
I found them on the internet. I looked for edible seaweed, and I found them. Some were using wakame. I mean, they were all different kinds of seaweed.
And where are they located, the suppliers?
I don't know. One person I talked to didn't sound like she had an Asian name at all. So I don't know who they were. But, I mean, I think they must have been dealing with another market, not edible the way I was describing it.
Sure. I mean, I know that there are suppliers in Canada that do dulse. There are growers along, you know, the western region of California and the Pacific Northwest. I just read an article about Oregon State University patenting a string of seaweed that they think tastes like bacon. It was in the Business Insider.
Right, I read that. Yes, that was, I read that. It tastes like bacon.
I mean, you know, seaweed has existed in many cultures for centuries. Even in Ireland, helped the people from the potato famine in the 1800s, you know, the Irish moss.
Uh-huh. Well, they have the different culps, I can picture them in my mind. Some of the, they're like seaweeds, really weeds that grow in the sea. And they harvest them off the coast of California.
Right. So there's so many, different types of seaweed and growers all around the world.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, and I was just going to say that, but our seaweed snacks are primarily consist of nori, which is the common name. The Latin name is porphyra, and it's a red algae. That's the same kind that you find, you know, in the sushi restaurants.
It's not red in sushi restaurants, though, is it?
No, because by the time it's dried, it looks kind of like a shiny, shimmery, greenish black.
Right,
you know?
That's it. You make the sheets that are just, they're sheets, dried.
Yes, they're lightly roasted and sprayed with organic extra virgin olive oil.
Okay. And then you have the chips.
And we came out with a new line of seaweed chips, which are it's rice on the outside and seaweed on the inside.
And it's called Chompies?
Chomper.
It's called what?
Chomper.
Chompers, okay.
Sounds like
that. And it's a much heartier snack. Uh-huh. You know, it feels filling and substantial. I mean, it's been compared to various people who have tried it have said that it reminds them of their favorite childhood snack. And people have compared it to bugles on the East Coast. They've compared it to Funyuns. They've compared it to pork rinds. But, of course, you know, it's not... It doesn't contain any pork.
Who are your major competitors?
Our major competitors, we sell primarily our customer base is in the health food, natural foods market.
Okay.
And so the only other one that I can think of is Gimme.
Oh, Gimme. Yeah, I wrote to them. I never saw them again.
Yeah, they're the only ones that I can think of. And they came around a little bit after us. They're also a good company, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I love it. Do you like it, Robert?
I ate all the licorice candy. So I kind of let you have all the seafood. I kind of let you have all the seaweed you want. I tend to associate South Korea with Hyundai cars and Samsung refrigerators, but both of which it happens that we own.
Yeah, that's true.
but I know that Anne loves seaweed, so I'm delighted that she has a supply. It keeps her quiet. It keeps her out of mischief, and it's really. A very intriguing thing. To me, it tastes salty, but is it tasting salty only because I know it came from the sea and therefore I assume it will be salty, or does it actually have some residual salt left in it?
We add just a pinch of sea salt.
Okay, right.
Which is better for you. And the seaweed is naturally salty, yes. It comes from the ocean and it's naturally salty.
Well, now there's only one thing we need to do now, aside from making sure that you send Anne a lifetime supply, is where when you don't have a friend who's the chief eating officer, and another friend who's the chief etc. officer, which is your husband, where can people lay their hands on this wonderful product?
Well, you can find us at Whole Foods.
Good.
And in your independent natural grocery market, like natural. Natural Grocers, Vitamin Cottage. We're in Sprouts on the western side of the U.S. and also on Amazon.
Okay, and do you have ordering from your website? Do you have website fulfillment?
Sure. People can also order directly from our website. That's www.csnacks.com. And we spell csnacks with an X at the end. Snacks with an AX.com.
Well, anyhow, I'm glad to have found you, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And
thank you.
Yeah, I hope you keep expanding your product line even.
We have so much in store for you, and we're going to send you the line because people can't have enough of it.
You have more.
There we go. Well, June, you may not be as useful to me as a Korean baseball player for my team, the Pittsburgh Pirates, but you're certainly invaluable to Mrs. Haig, and she's very pleased whether she can pronounce it or not.
Thanks, June.
Thank you so much, Anna Peter. It's a pleasure.
Now, if you're really feeling like you'd like to be healthy or healthier, there's an alternative to this ubiquitous juice cleanse. It's a soup cleanse, which actually is more up my line. Nicole Shazar is going to talk to us about her company, The Splendid Spoon.
And let's not forget to tell you that you can, and Miss Anne did it and then checked with the manufacturer. It's okay if you just drink it straight out of the bottle. It is not reported anywhere that people have been seen to pour it into a bowl and then crush sea snacks and put them on top. But it wouldn't surprise me if she does that too. Anyway, here's the producer of Splendid Soups.
The Splendid Spoon. You talk about love at first sight, and I have to admit to Nicole Shazar, is it Shazar?
Shazar,
that my first sight and taste of the products from the Splendid Spoon was not love at first sight. I launched into vegan bone broth, and I thought that was a bit much. By the time I finished it, which I did all by myself, and launched into some of the other flavors, I'm really addicted to this product, and I have no idea why. It's not my kind of thing, usually. I mean, I'm not vegan.
Why don't we let Nicole explain why?
Yeah, tell us about, give us a little background on how you came up with this, Nicole.
Sure.
The company, by the way, let's mention, is The Splendid Spoon, and it's really drinkable soup, which is a unique concept.
Yeah, the The drinkable soups are our newest product line, and it is soup in a bottle that makes it easy to enjoy a meal on the go and can be enjoyed chilled. It doesn't have to be warmed up. But the company itself is dedicated to all different varieties of soups, be it in the bottle or in a traditional pint container that can be warmed up, and started the business as a very intense personal passion project because I really believe that it's easier to access healthy food, more specifically fresh vegetables. And it just seems crazy to me that it was mostly sugary processed snacks that were available when I was on the move. And so it's been quite a journey to make it ever easier to get my healthy soups into the hands of customers.
Yeah, they're all vegan.
And that is definitely intentional because of the fact that so many of us just don't even get a couple servings of fruits and vegetables every day. I mean, we should be having five servings of vegetables every day.
And you give a guarantee that in each one of these bowlfuls of your soup, you get 3+ servings.
That's right. Yeah, we work with a registered dietitian on that. And, I mean, it's simple because we use very clean ingredients and we have the vegetables right at the top of the ingredient list there. I mean, if you look at it, it's purified water and then a whole bunch of vegetables in there and prepared with love and with a lot of attention to detail. I went to the French Connor Institute, so really making sure that each vegetable is prepared in the best way possible to maximize nutrient absorption.
You're actually a chef then?
Well, I went to culinary school. I went to the French Culinary Institute. I did the full classic culinary program. So, yes, I am considered a chef. I haven't spent a lot of time in restaurant kitchens, so I wouldn't consider myself, they're all different kinds of chefs.
Yeah, I get it.
Yes, I am formally trained.
Now, how many soups do you carry at one time? I got 4 bottles, and then I got the soup.
No soup.
Yeah, no, I got the one that's lentil and kale that comes in a little container that you heat.
Yeah, so we always have 5 different flavors available in the pints and 5 in the bottle, and we're looking to start bringing out more flavors on a regular basis. That's one of my big initiatives this year because everyone has a different favorite flavor of soup, kind of like ice cream.
Well, you started talking to us about you're thinking of your next flavors, and boy, talk about that beet thing. It sounded so great.
Yeah, so one of my favorite winter soups is borscht, which traditionally has beets, which are a wonderful root vegetable that can be stored without a lot of nutrient loss over time. And so I also believe really strongly in eating with your eyes first. So we have the beautiful ultraviolet color of beets, and I mix that with lots of really freshly grated horseradish and dill, and we'll be adding a tiny bit of cayenne to it to make it a little bit spicier also. That's one that I'm really excited about, a little bit of cabbage in there to make a richer broth and add more depth to the flavor.
Sounds like it might be a great Bloody Mary mix, never mind a soup.
It could. Our gazpacho is a wonderful Bloody Mary mix. We have tested it at the kitchen.
we never got any of that gazpacho, but it was a sensation at the Fancy Food Show in New York.
It was. Yeah, it was a big hit at the Fancy Food Show, yes.
Now, I still have to take issue with you over this vegan bone broth. Now, what kind of animal, please, has vegan bones?
Well, it's vegan bone for a few different reasons. The one, I'm sure you have heard about the craze around bone broth. So this is a little bit of a cheeky play on it because we are a totally plant-based company. But you can get all of the benefits of bone broth without the animal bones, and that's kind of what we're trying to aim to here, and that is improving your gut health. So there are all different ingredients in there that are really great food for the microbiotic flora that live in our system. So we call those prebiotics, things like onions and garlic. And then we also have lots of very antioxidant-rich veggies in there, shiitakes and spirulina and bok choy and kale. And all of this adds up to a really nutrient-dense broth that is great for not only your gut, but all other parts of you that benefit from plant power.
Well, you know, I think a little bit of hype is going on here, because I read about this company that had chicken broth.
Mm-hmm.
They changed the name to a bone broth, same soup, and they raised the price by a dollar and a quarter, and it sold out. What's the chef that we interviewed who started this whole thing with his window on near his restaurant in New York? What was this?
Oh, there was a guy who opened a soup kitchen.
Well,
but
no.
I don't remember who it was.
Bone though. Broth.
It's sort of like the soup Nazi.
No, he just had a little window next to his restaurant.
Well, the soup Nazi had a window,
Bruno
too.
Bruno is the famous one.
Yeah. No, this is another chef who had a restaurant somewhere lower down in Manhattan, but he also opened a special window where he just served simple soup. Like
he said
bone broth.
Yeah. So, but he says it's really the same thing as just broth or stock. So
it sounds to me a little bit like stone soup.
It does.
Every time I think of your soup,
it's a great book.
I don't know if you watch ads on, whether you see ads on television, but there's an ad with this guy who's dealing with someone who's personal, who's, I think, must be his personal trainer or something like that. And she says to him, "Are you still running?" And he says, "Almost every day." And she says, "Do you get your veggies?" And he says, "Sometimes," and she hits him in the head.
Why?
It just seemed rather unkind. She whacked him in the head. It's an ad for some kind of green juice product.
Well, we don't believe in whacking people over the head with it. I think, it's more about being a helping hand and being a realistic addition to someone's everyday diet.
Uh-huh. Now, I mean, like, how much of this do you make? I mean, what size company is this?
So we are making anywhere between 5,000 pounds of soup to 15,000 pounds of soup on a weekly basis.
That's a lot of soup.
That's a lot of soup.
It is a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of soup.
And you have a quirky distribution system. Explain to us how you get this soup. How do you get this soup?
So you order on the website. You can order blendedspoon.com, and you can order it as a deep salt sampler package or as a soup cleanse package. And we distribute nationally. So the soup is kept frozen in our warehouse, and it thaws slowly on its way to you. And by the time it first arrives, you can pop it right in your refrigerator and either enjoy a cleanse day or incorporate it into your everyday routine.
And you better have some, otherwise your personal trainer will hit you in the head.
I guess so.
Well, now, you brought up another issue. Is one of the things that you promote is instead, and you have very good reasons to sort of compare your soup to juice when you talk about your soup cleanse versus the juice cleanse that is such a hot issue.
Sure.
Why? Give us some of those points. I thought they were really very good on your website, which is, by the way, thesplendedspoon.com.
That's right.
Yeah, you gave some good points as to why a soup cleanse is better than a juice cleanse.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest reasons that juicing hasn't worked for me is that it's very high in sugar. So it is actually kind of a very food in that you're squeezing the vegetables and fruits, discarding all of the insoluble fiber, and you're left with a very concentrated mix of fructose, which is the sugar that comes from the
vegetables. I just hate sugar anyhow. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, I mean, your body digests sugar the same way regardless of where it comes from. And so it results in a lot of ups and downs, kind of like the sugar crash. And because you're discarding the fiber, you're also feeling hungry very quickly after consuming that beverage. And so soup is a meal. We're keeping the full vegetable fiber in there, which means that you stay satisfied a lot longer. And fiber is incredibly good for you, and one of the big reasons that you should be having 5 servings of vegetables every day. So there's that. And then there's also the fact that it's pulsed, and so we get to use a lot of ingredients that you could never have in a juice, things like beans and legumes the staying power of protein in those ingredients is certainly not to be underestimated.
Right. Now, you have good reasons for making it portable, too. Apparently, everybody's on the go anymore, right?
Yes, it is true. Ever busier, it seems like.
Sounds like you're on the go in the background there.
who's laughing?
Yeah, I'm actually in a cafe. I had a meeting right before this where I had to meet someone, so I just hunkered down here and for the call with you, yeah.
You're in New York?
I am, yeah.
Yes. So anyhow, so what other flavors are you dreaming up now?
One of my favorites is our winter root vegetable stew, which is made with a collard-free green broth, which I think has an almost meaty flavor, and collards are really rich in vitamin K and vitamin E. Vitamin K is actually similar to vitamin C. D, and that is really critical for your bone health, and you get better access to it after the vegetable has been cooked for a little while. So I love putting collards and other cruciferous vegetables just for that reason. And we also use some sweet potatoes and celery root or celeriac, depending on what you call it, which has a really fantastic flavor. Yeah, I absolutely love that flavor in the winter time, and so
yeah, you can
really
throw in some fennel too. You can get fennel in there.
Oh yeah, that would be a really nice flavor in there.
Oh, can I come work for you? I'd love thinking of these flavors. Can I be a flavor in
the
winter?
We should have a customer submission form for future flavors.
Yeah, we should. Somebody else is doing that.
Everyone has a nice soup memory, and I would love to make some of them come to life.
Yeah, we could have vegan chicken soup.
Well, listen, it was a revelation to me, Nicole, the Splendid Spoon, and I wish you well. And I'm happy to test all of your soups if you have
it. Thank you so much. I'm always looking for unbiased opinions for people who love soup.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
And I guess it's time to take a break, so we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to next take you south of the border. We're talking to Leslie Telez about her book, Eat Mexico, which is a variation on our Mexican cookbooks in that she focuses on street food. Well, I didn't think, actually, that I would see another book on Mexico this year, Leslie. Leslie Telez, Eat Mexico is your book. It's a little bit different from most of the Mexican books we've gotten, although there are plenty out there, because you do recipes from Mexico City only, and from, although there's a representation of other cities in Mexico City anyhow, which I guess we should mention, markets and fondas. How did you happen to focus in on Mexico City, number one, and this aspect of street food?
Well, I focused on Mexico City because I lived there for 4 years. I moved there in 2009 with my husband, and neither of us had ever lived in Mexico City before. Neither of us had ever lived in Mexico before. We had moved from Dallas, and I didn't have a job when I got there. We moved for my husband's job, but I had quit my job at the newspaper and followed him, you know, to Mexico.
I've done that.
Yeah.
How about Australia? I did that one.
Oh, wow.
She didn't write a book about Australian street food, though.
No, I didn't.
She might have done, but she didn't.
Yeah. Well, for me, I lived in a neighborhood. I happened to land in a neighborhood that had a really large representation of street food because it was an office district. We lived really close to my husband's job, and it was basically a financial area. So there were lots of office workers and a really high demand, therefore, for street food and for quick foods to go. So I didn't have a car, and when I would do my errands during the day, I would just walk and watch, really, and observe and see people huddled around these stands eating things that I had never seen before.
And which everybody will tell you not to eat street foods
exactly.
In Mexico City.
Exactly. And I had read in guidebooks and seen online, to avoid the street food in Mexico City, but everybody looked like they were enjoying it so much that I thought, oh, I have to try one of these things. Everything smells delicious. Everybody looks like they're really enjoying it. Why don't I just give it a shot? And the first time I did was when I had only been there for a couple weeks and I was still looking for an apartment for my husband and I. And I was so glad that I gave in to that impulse because it was some of the best food that I had ever tasted. I remember, I think it was a steak taco. It was some kind of taco. I believe it was a steak taco was the first thing I had tried. So, yeah, so that pretty much launched a love affair with the street food of Mexico City. And part of my getting to know the city was walking the streets a lot and just, again, observing these street foods and eating them where I could and asking a lot of questions and asking my Mexican friends what certain things were and getting people to go eat with me. And if I saw a stand that looked particularly busy, I would ask some friends, hey, do you want to go try this one out with me? And so we'd all go and we'd get to try more food because there was more of us. And, yeah, so that's why it focuses on street food and markets and fondas, because those were my original entryways into learning about what people eat, what most people eat or what the popular food is in Mexico City.
Now, I know what a market is. What's a fonda?
A fonda is a small, casual, mom-and-pop restaurant, meaning it's family-owned and operated almost 99.9% of the time, and they're only open during the day. They open usually, some of them are open for breakfast, but most of them are open between 1 and 6 p.m.
It's like a tiny restaurant as opposed to a food cart.
Correct. It's a brick and mortar. It has a brick and mortar location, but it wouldn't be considered a restaurant necessarily. There's a different class of things called restaurants, which tend to be a little nicer. A fonda is very clean always, but there might be plastic chairs. The food is very, very informal, very home style. There really aren't necessarily fancy touches involved. It's where you go to get good, solid, traditional Mexican food.
So it's a fonda. Why am I asking what's a fonda?
It's a fonda. Yes.
Yeah, it's not Jane or Henry, but it's a fonda still.
Well, Leslie, your heritage is part Mexican, right?
Yes, I'm Mexican-American.
Yeah, but you never learned, you said nothing ever quite made it to your generation. A language, food, customs, nothing.
Yeah, well, we had a little bit. The name of my food blog, or my food and travel blog, is the Mija Chronicles, and I called it Mija because it's the Spanish word for my daughter. It's kind of a mishmash of mi hija. And so my dad called me Mija, even though he didn't speak Spanish. He doesn't speak Spanish. He'll only speak it when forced, actually. I've only heard him speak Spanish once in my life. But yeah, that's one little thing that made it. But no, we weren't. I went to Mexico a couple times, I think, as a kid. My mom had spent a lot of time in Tijuana when she was growing up. But we didn't have a strong tie to Mexico. We didn't. I remember being really bewildered when we went to Mexico and we went to Tijuana. I was actually kind of scared. Like, what is this place? I can't understand anybody.
You seem to have absorbed a whole lot right away and really a lot in your 4 years there.
Yeah, I did. I just connected so quickly with the food. I threw myself into it and I had the time to do it. That was the big thing.
So there are things actually in this book that I don't know anything about, to be true, to be honest. Certain dishes that probably are typical, but I never had them.
Okay.
I never had the stuffed paddles, for example?
Oh, well, the last chapter in the book is not typical. So it's things that I cook at home. So it's ingredients that I came to know in Mexico City, such as cactus, amaranth, different things like that. But I use them in a way that's not typical. So the stuffed cactus paddles is just something that I came up with on my own. It's not something that people eat there.
I've had cactus paddles, but never had them stuffed.
Yeah, well, there is a dish, interestingly, there is a typical dish called a stuffed cactus paddle, now that I'm thinking of it. In Querétaro, I had one there. And it's you take a really large cactus paddle and you stuff it with a vegetable and meat mixture, and it's delicious. But it counts on the availability of a really large, very large cactus paddle, which in Mexico you can find. And I guess in the U.S. you could find it in people's yards, but in New York and throughout the U.S. I thought it might be difficult to come by. So.
Yeah. Actually, a farmer's market has it here, and I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I've never had green chorizo.
Oh, yeah. Green chorizo is really typical. I talk about this in the book. Really typical in Toluca, which is a city, I believe it's the capital of Mexico State, I want to say. But it's about an hour and a half-ish from Mexico City by bus. And, yeah, green chorizo is really common. So it's known, like the birthplace is Toluca, but you see it all over Mexico City, these kind of neon green sausage links hanging from the butcher counter. So
I worked in Toluca for several months.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did some work for General Motors de Mexico back in 2000, and one of my work sites was in Toluca.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, if you go to any of the markets there, it's really common to find it.
It's really funny. I never saw a town of Toluca. I saw lots and lots of Mexican citizens, but no town.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
I guess it's all factories, and then people just manage to live wherever they can.
Well, Toluca has a nice center, actually, center of town. They have a market in the square, and they have a really great kind of covered portico area where you can stroll and... They have a wonderful Sugar Skull Market during Day of the Dead that's in that area.
Okay, well,
I could go on and on about Toluca, but anyway. Yeah. Well,
General Motors never took us there. We had comida at the GM factory.
Oh, wow.
That one doesn't sound like much.
What's that?
Doesn't sound like much fun.
It wasn't much fun, but it saved a lot of time, I think. Time was of the essence. That was the key. You had to build more. You had to get people fed and get them back to work on their robots so they could make more Chevy Suburbans.
Sure.
You have some interesting personal observations along with your recipes, like with the huatzotl chicken soup. You have that you would be tempted, you'd buy them in the market and you get them home and try to figure out what you wanted to do with them.
Yeah. So the huatzontles are this really beautiful, not really dark green like a forest green, but maybe a couple shades darker than a Kelly green maybe, vegetable that's really tall, quite tall. In Mexico City they sell them, they might be about 2 feet long, 2.5 feet long, the stalks. So my husband actually would bring them home on his bicycle and they would stick out of his bike messenger bag as he was riding home. It was really funny. But yeah, I would see them and they don't sell them. I mean, you can get a lot of things in Mexico City at markets. You can get half of, or, you know, they'll sell you half a cabbage or a quarter cabbage. But the huatzontles, I could never figure out how to get less than a lot of them because they're pretty abundant. So yeah, I would take them home and just think, okay, well, what? I would kind of be seduced and captivated by, oh, this vegetable is so cool looking. And then I'd get home and say, okay, well, what actually am I going to do with this thing? And so the typical way people make it in Mexico City is to scrape off the bud, the little round buds of the stalk, and boil them in water, and then press them together, squeeze out all the water, and press them into a patty. And then you dunk that in egg batter. So I do have a recipe for those patties in the book, but there's so much huatzontle and only so many patties I could make. And with the egg batter, and the egg batter is deflating, and So, yeah, I just decided, well, what else can I do? And I thought, well, in chicken soup, it has a really nice texture. So I feel like in soup, it works great. In cooking school, we used it in a green salsa, which was really interesting. So, yeah, I really like it a lot. And you can find it in the U.S. at most Mexican grocery stores.
Yeah, that's right. You went to cooking school when you were there as well.
Yes.
And what kind of classes did you take?
Well, I decided to do a diploma in Mexican gastronomy. So there's a cooking school in Mexico City that is solely devoted to Mexican gastronomy. They're called the School of Mexican Gastronomy, as opposed to some of the other cooking schools that teach French technique and a little bit of everything.
Oh, okay.
But they teach Mexican cooking, about 90% Mexican cooking, and then they also have other courses you can take that don't really have to do with Mexican cooking, but they're things that people want to take, like how to make muffins and other stuff, Italian pastries and things. But yeah, I had read about, actually a friend had forwarded me their newsletter that they were teaching a class on salsa, and so I signed up in 2011, I think. I signed up for my first class, and I loved the salsa class. It was exactly up my alley. I just loved being able to make some of the things that I had tried on the street. And so the instructor said, if anybody really liked this class, we're launching a 14-month intensive diploma program where you learn pre-Hispanic cooking, Mexican cooking, all the way to modern-day Mexican cooking.
Now, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and not only do you do hands-on cooking classes, but you also get, he said, a lecture component. So half the class would be spent learning about Mexican food culture and politics and history. And so I thought, wow, that's even better. That's totally up my alley. So I decided to sign up. Even though my Spanish was not that great at the time, I was still learning a little bit, and I was really worried that I wasn't going to be able to understand what they were saying. But I did. After the first or second class, I was surprised. Oh no, I pretty much got it. So, and I would poke my fellow students in the hands-on portion if I didn't understand something, and uh-huh. People were very nice. So, yeah, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, you have some really interesting recipes in this book, but I wonder if you continue to make them, because the ingredients are so difficult to come by, like hibiscus flower quesadillas.
Well, hibiscus flowers you can find in Whole Foods. You can find in a lot of natural food stores. Hibiscus flowers have actually become really popular in the past 5-ish years, I would say. So hibiscus flowers, and you can find them online. So I haven't found that to be a problem. The hard part is finding good quality. So
yeah, I was going to say the texture is very different.
Exactly. Yeah, in Mexico City they're a lot chewier and heartier, and in the U.S. sometimes I found that they kind of fall apart in the water.
Right.
Not the same.
Well, now, do you find that in general, that, I mean, you think in general, that American or English speaking, I guess I should put it that way since it's mm-hmm. written in English, well, will they be able to source all these ingredients for these recipes?
For sure. I talk in the beginning of the book about my most commonly used ingredients and where to find them. And with the exception of one chile that I use in one recipe for the fish tacos, I have a salsa that calls for chile pasilla oaxaqueña, or oaxaqueño, actually, chile pasilla oaxaqueño. That chile is really difficult to source in the U.S. because it's grown in very small quantities in Oaxaca.
Uh-huh.
So it is hard to find in the U.S. Some places sell it online, but it is difficult, and you're not going to get the same flavor from any other chile. So the rest of the recipes, though, you can find all the chilies online or in a Mexican grocery store. The herbs and different things you can find at Mexican grocery stores. I think if you're living in Omaha or you're living in, I mean, I randomly picked Omaha. That might be a bad example because I've never been there. But if you're living in a place that doesn't have any sort of Mexican immigrant population at all, then it might be difficult for you to find. But my husband's family, for instance, lives in Star, South Carolina, which is a very tiny town.
Where is that near, by the way, Star?
It's near Anderson, South Carolina, which is near
Greenville. Oh, I know. Now, we have friends that live, we have our family, our children, grandchildren live in Greenwood, and we've been to Greenville and Greenwood a lot, South Carolina.
Okay. Yeah, it's near there, but
so
on the way
Anderson.
To Star, you can find, we found a Mexican market.
Yeah.
So they do exist. I think it may take a little bit of searching, but so many cities in the U.S. have historic Mexican-American populations like Los Angeles, Chicago, Phoenix. Obviously, you're not going to have any problems finding any of these ingredients there. But a lot of cities in the south and in the northwest have also been experiencing booms in Mexican immigration. So you can find now, you didn't used to be able to, but you can find now these ingredients. The same thing in New York. 20 years ago, I don't think you could find fresh epazote, but now you can.
I remember Jacques Pepin said when he first came to America, he couldn't even find fresh mushrooms at the supermarket.
I believe that, yeah.
Where are you now, Lizzie? Are you still in Mexico City or are you back in the U.S.?
No, I moved to New York in 2013. Okay. Yes, I live here now.
Now, well, I was going to say the other thing I wanted to mention was that if you do everything, like from your point of view, like making your own tortillas, this is a very time-consuming way of cooking.
Yes. I talk about this a little bit in the book, but
you
Mexican
say you
cooking,
can't take any shortcuts with Mexican cooking.
Yeah. I mean, the tradition, the culinary traditions are really strong, and the theme that runs through the culinary tradition is that it's a cuisine that you spend time with and you get to know, and that you're not necessarily in a hurry. I do think that there are some dishes that not every dish is really time-consuming and labor-intensive. If you flipped through the book, there's things like chicken tinga and certain guisados rajas con crema, which are the charred poblano peppers with cheese, different stewed vegetable dishes that don't take a lot of time. I think in the U.S., we're used to so many shortcuts and so many convenience foods. And in Mexico, while convenience foods have made inroads, I think, at convenience stores and in supermarkets, there's still not a really big culture like there is in the U.S. of eating, you know, something fast and quick and getting dinner on the table in 20 minutes.
Right.
That's not the culture. So the culture is to spend 2 hours eating lunch.
Right.
And so many families have these really great recipes that nobody's written down, but of these wonderful sauces and meats and everybody going over to a family member's house on Sunday and spending 3, 4, 5, 6 hours just with their family eating, and that's the culture. So yeah, I don't view it as, oh God, it's just this labor intensive thing. You know, there's definitely dishes that take a lot of time, but that's part of the culture. That's what you, if you put in the time and you get to know it, I think it's rewarding.
Well, I wish you a great deal of luck with this book. And you've got some nice people giving testimonials. Rick Bayless, Sean Brock, Maricel Precia. I mean, boy, that's a good lineup of what do you call those things? Not testimonial. Blurbs. There's a nicer name.
Thank you.
Endorsements. Was that not right? Anyhow.
Yeah.
Blurbs, they called.
And blurbs. So anyhow, so I wish you luck for the book, and I wish you luck for the baby. What kind of baby is it?
He's a boy.
Oh, he's a boy.
Yeah, 5-month-old boy now.
Okay. Well, say hello. Give him
I will.
A mean pinch in the cheek for me.
I will.
Okay, Leslie, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And while you think about what Donald Trump might have to say about that, let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And to close out today's program, we're staying south of the border. We're going to avoid breaking into song, thank goodness.
How did you know I was going to do that?
Well, I was hoping you wouldn't. but these empanadas apparently are world famous, worldwide, and Cornish pasty really is one too.
Right.
Although I don't think the Cornish miners would really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, but Sandra Gutierrez is one of our favorite people to interview about her books, and here she is talking about
a whole book on
empanadas. Sandra Gutierrez, this empanadas, the handheld pies of Latin America, that the very format of the book is sort of like the character of an empanada. Packed, it's easy to hold, it's tidy and clear in what you're getting. I thought that the format was very lovely.
Probably doesn't taste very good, though.
Oh, no, I didn't eat it, no. I thought I knew about empanadas, but I didn't know some of the facts. One of the interesting things about the book is you start out in your introduction by tracing the history. I didn't have a clue that it went back so far for an empanada.
It is a fascinating history of empanadas, really, when you can go back really to the year 250 BCE, all the way back to what is now modern-day Iran. And you find the first empanadas, which were originally made with a crust that wasn't edible. It was really a parcel made with flour and salt in which people could put really nice fillings with mutton or lamb and fruits that they could travel with. So soldiers used to take it in during their conquests and their travels. And it slowly transformed into an edible crust. So, yeah, empanadas go a long way back.
Yeah, and I also didn't really understand how many different types, shape, dough, and not even mention the fillings, of course. Give us a little clue at the variety of shapes and pastry.
Yeah, it's very interesting because empanar means to wrap in bread. And in Latin America, once the Spaniards come in and they bring wheat-based empanadas, which was the first empanada to make it to the New World, we started changing them and using what was indigenous to the area. So there are many empanadas that have doughs that are naturally gluten-free, made with either plantains or yuca, also known as cassava. And that's the bread. That becomes bread when you cook it. There are others, of course, in Mexico and Central America, we use nixtamalized corn, which is masa, and those are also gluten-free. And then, of course, we use the wheat-based ones, and in Brazil, they actually use a dough that's very similar to pasta, made without eggs, but very, very thinly rolled and then deep-fried, and it becomes crusty and flaky. Yeah. So we do have very different types of dough. In the book, I have 10 different doughs, which is great, and includes a lot of those that I mentioned. The other thing that makes it interesting in Latin America is that the shapes vary, as they do around the world. For instance, in India, you have samosas, which are, of course, the triangular, like pyramids. But in Latin America, they vary by shape because normally, depending on where you are, you're able to figure out what's inside the empanada by the shape that it has. So, for instance, in Peru, you will find large, almost the size of your hand, empanadas that are shaped round with a roped edge. In most of Latin America, you will find the traditional half-moon-shaped empanadas, the one we most recognize. But in other parts of Latin America, in Argentina, for instance, you will find them half-mooned with a braided edge if they have meat inside, or pointy edges if they have corn. Some of them are fried, some of them are baked. Ones in Argentina and Chile are famously baked in a wood oven. Other shapes that you have in Latin America are these square rectangle ones that are made with that dough that I was talking about in Brazil. So they look almost like pockets, like the Pop-Tarts, really, that kids grow up here. But it's Pop-Tarts taken to quite another level. They're really, really delicious. And then, of course, you have triangular ones. You have ones that are almost like ravioli shaped. So we have a lot of shapes in Latin America, a lot of sizes as well. Some of them are as big as a plate. There are some football-shaped ones that can fit in your hand also. You can hold them. And then you have the little itty-bitty ones that are made for appetizers. So you have all different shapes, all different sizes, and, of course, all different kinds of fillings, from very savory fillings to sweet and savory fillings, meats with raisins or meats with olive eggs and raisin fillings. And then you have those that are savory inside and they roll them into sugar outside. The pastry is rolled into sugar so that you have that sweet savory sensation again. And then you have those that are, of course, all sweet, like the famous dulce de leche and apple empanadas from Argentina that are in the book as well.
Now, do all of them have this same sort of edge on them that's just the dough? You know,
No, they don't.
See,
they don't.
The story about that we were told is with the Cornish pasty, which is about the country in England where my brother lives, that they made the crust overlap that way so that the miners who were mining for tin and copper way back two or three hundred years ago would be able to have something to hold on to, and because their hands would be dirty, so they would just hold on to the pastry and throw it away when they were done, when they'd eaten everything that was inside of it.
And that makes a lot of sense, because the dough, when you shape it into the bread, like rope that you put outside on the edges of some of them, particularly the Argentinians and some of the South American empanadas, which are made with a bread-like dough, becomes very tough on the outside. So it's also, depending on what your ratio of flour and water is, it could be too hard to actually eat. So it's a great, I love that story. In Latin America, we inherited that shape from the Spaniards. So, that is how it gets to Latin America. And it just continued, but only in those countries that use wheat-based dough.
Okay, so it might be that there's a very similar explanation, and it was miners in Spain, because they did a lot of mining on the northern coast of Spain for many, many years. They don't do much anymore because they worked all the mineral ores out. But it could very well be the same reason.
Now, absolutely.
I'd like your recommendation for using a tortilla press to shape those things. I mean, that seems so reasonable.
You know, I'm a very practical cook, and because I teach cooking all around the country, I'm always meeting people who tell me that they love to bake or cook, but they don't have time.
Oh, yeah.
And so in South America and in many of these countries, you have to roll out the dough with a rolling pin, and I also offer directions to do that. But I developed the recipes for the dough so that they can particularly work with a tortilla press, which, of course, Argentinians and Chileans must be balking right now. They're listening to this interview. But it's very – because they don't do that. They roll them out, and then they cut them out in circles, little cookie cutters or whatever. But it really makes a lot of sense for people who are on the run to be able to shape all the dough into balls and then just press them down into discs. And it makes it so much quicker, the process. And I really want people to go home and make these empanadas and enjoy it without feeling that they don't have the time to prepare them.
And now, you have a whole bunch of different ingredients and equipment. It seems kind of complicated, but most people can find everything online, I guess, huh?
Yes, actually, most of us can now, in the United States at least, I will say, and of course Latin America, we can find all of the ingredients in traditional supermarkets, and in most of Europe and Asia as well, because most of the ingredients that we use to make empanadas and fillings are not very exotic. But if some of them are, if it's hard for you to find, for instance, jalapeno pepper, because you live in the middle of somewhere that you cannot find them, I offer in the book a list of sources where you can easily order them online. And it's fabulous, really, to be able to order, you know, 2 or 3 ingredients and have them delivered to your house. But most of the Latin ingredients that you will need, they're very simple to find around where you live.
Right. I found yucca in Kansas City.
Yes, isn't it incredible? You can find them, and of course we can find it in the freezer section, already peeled and cut in the right size for us to just boil and mash. I mean, it's incredible the amount of products, and it's because we have, of course, much larger populations of Latinos and Hispanics all over the world now, not only in the U.S. I was so impressed when I was doing the research for this book. How many countries in Europe and in Europe and in other places in the world sell empanadas on a regular basis? There's a restaurant in Paris that delivers handmade empanadas to people's homes. I mean, there in Berlin, I found restaurants of great Argentinian empanadas. So the empanada trend, it came from Europe to the New World, but now Latin Americans have so exponentially grown the number and the varieties of empanadas that we are now exporting them all over the world, and they've become quite trendy because, of course, they're portable. You can carry them wherever you go. They're easy to eat, and they're super easy to freeze and to store. So I think that this trend is just going to continue to get larger and larger as time goes by.
I have a sin to confess.
Oh, you do? You have a sin to confess that you bought yucca and you served it to me and I said it tasted like candle wax. I think it was not very good yucca.
Well, no, I think that's what yucca tastes like, to tell you the truth. No, I must admit, and I've regretted it when I think back, but it was so easy at the time. I let our son Adam eat those horrible frozen Hot Pockets.
Oh, well, you know what? You have to start somewhere, right? but I'll tell you, with my book now, you can make all the empanadas, and I give you recipe by recipe the instructions to freezing and reheating each kind. So that now you can have your freezers full of the real Latin American pockets and just stick them in the oven and they'll be just as easy as the ones you gave your son.
I'm wondering if there isn't a connection between empanadas and a famous delicacy in Australia and in South Africa, I guess, called meat pies. They're more pie-shaped. Rather than, you know, they're not as flat, they're a little more substantial. But it's the same idea.
It's wrapping a filling in pastry. And in Brazil, they have empanadas that are called empadas. And those are usually stuffed with hearts of palm and olives. It's also a vegetarian recipe. And they're made in little pie shapes also. So you grab a little pie. It looks just like a mini pie. They're gorgeous, and some of the decorations are super intricate. I have that recipe in Latin American street food in my second book. And so you have them even within countries and within regions and within cities of each country. You find them in different shapes and with different kinds of dough. It's fascinating.
I love the way you suggest that you can creatively make your own empanada with leftovers. We actually did the reverse the other day. We were at a restaurant called Taco, which makes tacos, and we took the tacos that were left over with us as we went out to the restaurant, and we ate them for breakfast.
There you go.
And they were pretty good, considering they hadn't been heated up. They were pretty good.
cold tacos. A little hard in the system, actually. Of all these recipes, I mean, it's hard, of course, for you to, well, just point out some of the, of what you consider to be the most unusual or the most delicious.
I'll tell you where unusual recipes come. I would say that Ecuadorian onion and cheese pies, they're called light as air onion and cheese pies. And we call them empanadas de viento in Spanish, which means very light as air empanadas. Because they're filled with onion and cheese, you'd think they'd be savory, but they're actually deep fried and then they're rolled into sugar. And they are so wonderful to serve with a cheese course at the end or with some bubbly or sparkling wine. It's really a surprising taste if you've never had them.
How do you spell it?
Empanadas de viento, that is, empanada is E-M.
No, we know about that, but the next word.
De viento is D as in donut E, and viento, which means air, is V-I-E-N-T-O.
That sounds good.
It's delicious.
I mean, if you're making something for a special, say, dinner for somebody, and you're going to have some empanadas, which recipe would you use?
Definitely the Chilean empanadas, and in the book they're called the famous beef, raisin, and olive hand pie.
Oh yes, aren't they? They sound absolutely splendid.
They're delicious and they're large. They look like envelopes. So it's a rectangular shape with just the folds like an envelope, and they're served with a wonderful sauce, which I also have in the book, called pebre, which is a pepper and onion salsa. And the combination is so spectacular.
Yeah, that's something that we should mention. In addition to the basic empanada, you have a section where you have different sauces to serve with them.
Correct, because the book features empanadas from all of Latin America, so all the way from Mexico to Brazil, and depending where you are, some of those empanadas will be served with sauces. So I tell you which ones pair with what kind of empanada. so that you can stay authentic. But what I love about making empanadas is once you know what authentic Latin American empanadas are like, you can really go to your kitchen and create your own. One of my daughter's favorite empanadas is made with my flaky paste, my flaky dough in the book, and it's filled with peanut butter and jelly. So.
Now, do you have an empanada website?
I don't have a website. I don't. No, but you know, the book is there for people to do all the empanadas.
Okay, well, good luck with this book, Sandra.
Thank you.
They're the handiest. I don't mean to be punny, but they are the handiest food and has been for centuries. And you do such a great job of presenting the broad scope of possibilities with empanadas.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on, and I hope that you all enjoy the book and learning about a Latin American empanada.
Yes, well, I'm going to pass this book along to my daughter-in-law so that she doesn't give my grandchildren those hot pockets.
There you go.
And there you have it, another week's program of On the Menu Radio. We hope you enjoyed and that you'll join us again same place.
Yeah, and time and whatever.
And time and all that stuff. There you go.
Until next week.
I must have had a piece of empanada stuck in the corner of my mouth. Right. Boy, we've been guzzling this week, have we not?
We have.
Sea snacks, splendid soup.
Yeah, I like that.
Mexican street food and empanadas. Who knows where we'll go next week? You better join us to find out.
Bye-bye.